Steve Jobs was born on February 24, 1955, in San Francisco, California. His birth instrument bore the names Abdulfattah Jandali and Joan Schiebel, his natural parents, but a child would be espoused within days by Paul and Clara Jobs, a working-class couple from Mountain View. From a veritably morning, his life sounded poised between contrast the query of relinquishment, the stability of a nurturing home, and the turnabout of restless ambition that would define him. Paul Jobs was a machinist, a man whose hands understood the language of tools and perfection. He had a quiet pride in structure and fixing effects, from auto machines to menage appliances. Clara Jobs, a kind and practical woman, worked as an accountant, keeping figures in order but no way losing her warmth. Together, they handed Steve a menage of love and discipline, though not without challenges. The couple's values, hard work, resourcefulness, and tone reliance, would translate into Steve's knowledge beforehand, shaping a mindset that valued independence, but also perfection. Indeed, as a small child, Steve displayed flashes of intensity and curiosity. He wasn't the type to be fluently gratified or distracted. Toys weren't simply toys for him. They were objects to be examined, deconstructed, and understood. A simple transistor radio came a portal to disquisition. The cables, the circuitry, the mechanical language within, all of it fascinated him. Unlike numerous children who see a toy as a source of transitory pleasure, Steve sought understanding, the mechanics beneath the face. This drive for appreciation, nearly preoccupation, would latterly define the way he approached design, technology, and indeed business. School was a mixed geography. Steve was bright, yet changeable. Preceptors frequently noticed his intelligence, but were occasionally frustrated by his defilement toward traditional classroom structures. Rules and rote memorization bored him, but when commodity captured his imagination, electronics, mechanics, computers, his focus was absolute. Then's a thing beforehand on. It came clear that Steve's mind worked else. While other children followed paths laid out by instruction, he navigated according to curiosity, suspicion, and instinct. At home, his parents encouraged his interests, especially Paul. Father and son spent numerous hours in the garage, a place that would latterly come fabulous in the story of Apple. The garage wasn't just a factory. It was a macrocosm of possibilities. Motors, cables, switches, and scrap essence littered the space. But in Steve's eyes, it was rich ground for invention. Paul no way forced Steve to learn. He simply handed access to tools and knowledge. That freedom, combined with his father's quiet mentorship, tutored him that making and creating was not only satisfying but possible. One yarn from these early times captures Steve's arising character. Paul formally watched him disassemble a family appliance, a toaster oven, not for fun, but to understand how it worked. By the time he was 10, Steve had formally erected rudimentary electronics and experimented with introductory engineering generalities, frequently guided by primers, magazines, and his grim questioning. It was a constructive experience, one that combined imagination, specialized skill, and amenability to challenge convention, traits that would latterly come synonymous with his approach to Apple. Steve's personality, still, was confined to specialized curiosity. He was fiercely individualistic. Socially, he could be awkward, violent, and indeed combative. He defied authority, especially when he felt it stifled creativity. In classrooms and latterly in nonage, this particularity would manifest in conflicts with preceptors, classmates, and ultimately employers. But what this really meant was that Steve was cultivating a sense of tone, reliance, and vision. He'd not follow unless he could see the purpose, the bigger picture, or the fineness in the system he was part of. By the mid-1960s, the artistic environment of Steve's nonage began to play its part. The Silicon Valley region was on the cusp of metamorphosis, though utmost people didn't notice it yet. Electronics companies like Hewlett Packard were small but influential, embodying a do-it-yourself mastermind-driven morality. The counterculture was rising, with its emphasis on questioning authority and exploring new ideas. Steve absorbed these swings intimately. He'd latterly say that his life and career were shaped as important by ideas from outside the family, from a neighborhood, the original assiduity, the stirring culture, as by his own parents' guidance. High Academy marked a turning point. By his early teens, Steve was attending Homestead High in Cupertino. It was there, he met people who would latterly become lifelong collaborators and challengers. Steve gravitated toward electronics and engineering clubs, forming Gemütlichkeit with, like, inclined peers. He also met Bill Fernandez, an early collaborator who introduced him to a youthful Steve Wozniak. Their fellowship, erected on participated curiosity and the exhilaration of discovery, would come vital. Wozniak, the specialized genius with a sportful, experimental mind, rounded Steve's visionary intensity. Together, they represented a combination of specialized mastery and aesthetic ambition that would latterly define Apple. Steve's teenage times were also marked by trial and rebellion. He was drawn to unusual ideas, indispensable doctrines, and spiritual disquisition. He read voraciously, not just specialized primers, but works on Eastern gospel literature and countercultural study. By the late 1960s, he began experimenting with psychedelic jest commodity that would latterly impact his views on creativity, perception, and business. His intensity occasionally alienated him from peers, but also fueled the development of a distinct worldview. Life was and about following rules. It was about sapience, invention, and purpose. Summer jobs and internships offered practical grounding. Steve sought out work at Hewlett-Packard, immersing himself in real-world electronics. He observed how masterminds answer problems, how systems were structured, and how invention happened within a business. But then's a subtle point: while he admired the specialized skill around him, Steve chafed at commercial scales. He respected imagination, but despised bureaucracy. Indeed, at 17, he was formally cultivating a sense of what it would mean to produce his own path, a company, a product, a culture that was uncompromisingly his vision. The combination of these just hands-on learning with his father, Gemütlichkeit with blessed peers, exposure to the arising tech culture of Silicon Valley, spiritual and philosophical disquisition, created a unique intellectual ecosystem around Steve. He was no longer just a curious child or rebellious teenager. He was developing the core traits that would define his adult life: intensity, vision, perfectionism, and incapability to see possibilities where others saw none. By the time Steve graduated from High Academy in 1972, he was formally allowing else about life and work. He enrolled at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, not because it was a path to traditional success, but because it offered intellectual freedom. Then he dropped in and out of classes, fascinated by penmanship, gospel, and literature, putatively unconnected fields, but each contributing to the aesthetic sensibility and attention to detail that would latterly
come emblems of Apple products. Reed College was lower about credentials and further about shaping perspective. The courses Steve pursued, penmanship, typography, and the trades, may have sounded trivial, but they directly told the fineness, simplicity, and beauty of the Macintosh interface. Family connections during this period were complex. Paul and Clara encouraged independence, but upset about Steve's unconventional path. Steve, for his part, valued their support, but felt constrained by ordinary prospects. It was a time of pressure and growth. He experimented with diets, contemplation, and collaborative living, reflecting the counterculture spirit of the period. He was searching not just for a career, but for meaning, identity, and a system of life that aligned with his values. In 1972, Steve returned to California after leaving Reed College. He took a job at Atari, a pioneering videotape game company. Though youthful and inexperienced, his brilliance and intensity snappily came apparent. Steve wasn't simply a technician. He was a visionary who wanted to understand the purpose behind the technology. At Atari, he learned assignments about business, design, and mortal jest that would latterly inform Apple's product gospel. Occasion 1, Part 1 closes on a note of eventuality. Steve Jobs, in his late teens and early 20s, was a blend of intensity, curiosity, rebellion, and vision. The seeds of the Apple conglomerate were formally planted, nourished by family support, Gemütlichkeit, exposure to Silicon Valley, and a restless intellect. What's remarkable is how numerous rudiments of his adult personality, perfectionism, desirousness, brilliance, and occasional ruthlessness, were formerly visible, still taking shape in the garage, the classrooms, and the corridors of early tech culture. The stage was set. A youthful man on the edge of invention, driven not by convention but by vision, was about to enter the world. After leaving Reed College in 1972, Steve Jobs returned to California with a restless energy and a hunger for purpose. He was a youthful man without a clear path, but fortified with violent curiosity and a vision that would not be regulated. California in the early 1970s was a place of incongruity, the serenity of the seacoast, and redwoods varied sprucely with the buzzing chaos of a rising technology capitals. For Steve, the terrain was electric, brimming with possibilities that utmost people did and yet see. Steve's first real exposure to the professional technology world came through Atari, the videotape game company that was also introducing Hall Games. He was hired as a technician, responsible for troubleshooting and testing games. At Atari, Steve was an just in hand. He was a bystander of creativity under constraint. He saw how design, engineering, and request forces bisected, and how invention could be both stirring and frustrating. His intensity set him piecemeal. Associates noticed his brilliance, but also his desirousness and exacting norms. Steve was formerly a visionary in a world still learning to fate vision. It was at Atari that he first began experimenting with the idea of creating commodity entirely of his own, commodity that combined technology and art in ways the world had unseen. The experience with Atari, though brief, tutored him a crucial assignment: systems and products are further than their factors, their jests, and every detail matters. Atari, for all its imagination, operated on deadlines, budgets, and scale, and Steve chafed at these limitations. He wanted freedom to introduce without concession. During this period, Steve reconnected with his old friend Bill Wozniak. Wozniak was a specialized genius, brilliant with circuits and computers, yet sportful, unpretentious, and driven by curiosity rather than ambition. Steve honored commodity rare in Wozniak the capability to turn abstract ideas into performing technology with fineness and simplicity. Their personalities rounded each other impeccably. Where Wozniak had skill and tolerance, Steve had vision and asseveration on perfection. Together, they would form a cooperation that would review the particular computer. The cooperation began still in Wozniak's bedroom and laterally expanded to Steve's family garage. The Jobs family garage, located in Los Altos, was unpretentious but sacred. Paul Jobs had erected it as a practical workspace, but to Steve and Wozniak, it came a laboratory, a place where imagination could take physical form. Then, the brace began tinkering with electronics not as potterers, but as settlers. They experimented with circuits, programming, and small computer systems. It was in period of hands-on literacy, a time when silicon chips were new and the particular computer conception was just arising from the minds of visionaries like Steve and Wozniak. One of their foremost cooperative systems was the development of the Apple I. Wozniak had designed a completely functional particular computer, compact and simpler than anything differently on the request at the time. It was the kind of machine that didn't just live for masterminds. It was designed for people, a radical conception in a period when computers were massive, institutional machines. Steve's part, still, was ent in specialized design but envisioning a product, allowing about donation and understanding the mortal appeal. He pushed Wozniak to not only make but to consider how people would use the machine, how it would look, and how it would be vended. Then, Steve's instinct for incorporating technology with aesthetic and stoner experience began to crop. The brace faced multitudinous obstacles. Backing was tight. Early product meant scavenging corridor, soldering factors by hand, and satisfying suppliers to work with a bitsy, improving adventure. Steve's intensity occasionally created disunion. He was known to be demanding, averring on perfection indeed when the coffers were scarce. Wozniak, calmer and scrupulous, frequently absorbed the pressure, rephrasing Steve's vision into reality. Their dynamic was electric disunion and community in equal measure. By 1976, the Apple I was ready. But erecting the machine was only half the battle. Dealing it was another. Steve abused his understanding of mortal jest, his conclusive seductiveness, and his capability to frame technology as commodity aspirational. He vended the first batch of Apple I computers to original potterers and small businesses. The success was modest, but it validated a conception that would soon explode the particular computer as a menage point, not a commercial luxury. The early Apple operation was, in numerous ways, chaotic. Jobs was the face, the marketer, the visionary. Wozniak was the brain, the mastermind, the scrupulous handicraftsman. They worked in the garage girdled by lines, chips, and circuit boards, occasionally sleeping on new beds, driven by sheer preoccupation. Steve's intensity was palpable. He believed that this design wasn't simply a business, but a revolution in allowing, a way to put power and creativity into the hands of individualities. He demanded perfection, frequently colliding with suppliers, associates, and
indeed musketeers. But the clarity of his vision kept the platoon moving forward. It was also during this time that Steve's gospel about design and aesthetics formed. He believed that product shouldn't only serve faultlessly, but also elicit emotion. He studied typography, penmanship, and art, integrating assignments from putatively unconnected fields into technology. The fineness of Macintosh interface, times latterly, had its roots then in the preoccupation with simplicity, beauty, and usability. To Steve, a product was then just an object. It was an experience. The business side was a challenge. Steve, at 21, had little knowledge of commercial finance or strategy, but he'd instinct, suspicion, and an imperturbable belief in the product. To secure backing, he sought out investors, pitching the Apple One with a combination of specialized sapience and seductiveness. One of the early investors, Mike Markula, honored Steve's brilliance and offered mentorship and capital, helping transfigure garage design into a formal company. Apple Computer Incorporated. Markula's involvement was critical, furnishing not just plutocrat but guidance in structuring the company, spanning product and marketing to a broader followership. Meanwhile, Steve's particular life was evolving. He remained restless, exploring spiritual and philosophical ideas. Passages to India in 1974 strengthened his interest in Zen Buddhism and indispensable cultures. He experimented with diets, contemplation, and minimalist living, seeking clarity of mind and vision. These jests, though putatively particular and unconventional, would latterly impact his approach to design, business, and leadership. Steve believed that suspicion and sapience were as precious as specialized skill, and his time abroad corroborated the notion that perception, simplicity, and clarity were essential in every aspect of life, from particular conduct to product design. By 1977, the Apple II was in development, erecting upon the modest success of the Apple I. The Apple II was a vault-forward color plates, expandability, and a design that appealed to both potterers and businesses. Steve's asseveration on stoner experience, satiny design, and intuitive operation came a hallmark. He pushed masterminds and contrivers relentlessly, seeking for a product that was not only functional but transformative. Beforehand, testers frequently complained about his intensity, but the results spoke for themselves. The Apple II was revolutionary, setting the stage for a particular computing revolution. During these constructive times, Steve Jobs also cultivated a character for intensity and exacting norms. Workers and collaborators snappily learned that Steve's vision came with prospects of absolute commitment. He could be attractive, inspiring, and conclusive, but also ruthless and intolerant. Opinions were frequently guided by instinct rather than analysis, and failure to meet his norms was met with sharper view. Yet, beneath the intensity was a driving principle: products must be perfect, not just acceptable. Mediocrity, to Steve, was inferior. The social and artistic environment cannot be overlooked. Silicon Valley was a melting pot of youthful masterminds, romanticists, and counterculture thinkers. Steve thrived in this terrain, absorbing ideas about technology, business, and life. Yet, he remained singular, unintentional to conform entirely. He rejected purely commercial paths, sought alleviation in art, and pursued just that stone of creativity and suspicion. The collision of specialized skill, aesthetic sensibility, and philosophical curiosity created a unique lens through which Steve viewed the world, one that would latterly review not just Apple but the entire tech assiduity. Occasion 1, Part 2 concludes at a vital juncture. Apple, though still in its immaturity, had transitioned from garage trials to a rookie company with a product poised to change the world. The cooperation between Jobs and Wozniak was solidifying, Markula's mentorship handed structure and backing, and Steve's vision for technology as an accessible, beautiful, and transformative tool was beginning to take palpable shape. The seeds of a revolution were sown, but the challenges ahead, spanning the company, managing gift, and navigating a fleetly evolving request, were only just arising. What's clear at this stage is that Steve Jobs was no longer just a curious teenager in a garage. He was a youthful visionary, unafraid of conflict, obsessed with perfection, and committed to transubstantiating how people interacted with technology. His story, still in its first act, promised bouleversement, invention, and the grim pursuit of excellence that would define a generation. By 1977, Apple was poised on the point of a technological revolution. The Apple II was nearly ready for launch, and the atmosphere in the garage turned office was electric with expectation and pressure. For Steve Jobs, these were exhilarating days, filled with possibility, frustration, and unvarying drive to perfect every detail. The youthful visionary, slightly in his 20s, was beginning to realize that invention alone was not enough. Prosecution, donation, and timing were inversely vital. The Apple II differed from the Apple I in significant ways. While the Apple I was a layman's machine, limited in compass and product, the Apple II was designed for the millions. It had a color display, sound capabilities, and a modular design that allowed druggies to expand and customize their experience. More importantly, it had aesthetic appeal. Steve claimed on a satiny plastic covering rather than a bare circuit board, believing that the appearance of machines signified as important as its functionality. This focus on design, on marrying form of function, came a hallmark of his career. Securing backing and product capacity was an ongoing challenge. Apple's small platoon reckoned on imagination, persuasion, and sheer continuity. Steve's personality, violent and demanding, was both a driving force and a source of disunion. He was known for his sharp lingo and desirousness, pushing workers to their limits. Yet, he also had an uncanny capability to inspire fidelity. People who worked with him honored that, beneath the intensity, there was a vision, one that promised to reshape technology and, in a sense, the world itself. The launch of the Apple II in April 1977 marked a turning point. Unlike numerous early tech products, it was then confined to potterers and masterminds. It appealed to businesses, seminaries, and families. Its intuitive interface, expandability, and visual appeal set it piecemeal from the competition. Steve's asseveration on fineness and usability paid off. Apple was no longer a small garage design. It was a company with a product able of impacting a generation. Steve's leadership style was formally distinctive. He demanded perfection in design and prosecution, frequently colliding with masterminds who felt his norms were unrealistic. Yet, he had a knack for seeing eventuality where others saw limitations. He combined specialized understanding with a sense of the emotional impact of technology, how products made people feel. To him, a computer wasn't just a tool. It was an extension of the mind, a oil for creativity, and a symbol of mortal eventuality. This gospel would define Apple's approach for decades. Marketing played a pivotal part in Apple's early success. Steve honored that dealing technology wasn't just about specs.
It was about Lyre. He framed the Apple II as further than a computer. It was a means to empower individualities, to homogenize technology, and to make creativity accessible. The company's announcements, packaging, and product demonstrations reflected his vision. Every detail was purposeful, every communication precisely drafted. Steve understood the psychology of perception, the power of donation, and the subtle art of persuasion. The Apple II's success brought challenges as well as openings. Demand exceeded force, taking rapid-fire scaling of product and support. The youthful company faced growing pains, navigating logistics, distribution, and client service. Steve's perfectionism came both a strength and a liability. He claimed on controlling every aspect of the product experience, from tackle to packaging, occasionally colliding with investors and platoon members. But this asseveration on excellence created a culture of quality that would come synonymous with Apple. During these times, Steve's personality continued to evolve. He was attractive, conclusive, and decreasingly confident in his vision, but also decreasingly demanding and sometimes unpredictable. Workers described violent highs and lows, moments of alleviation and brilliance, followed by sharp review or abrupt changes in direction. Yet, indeed, those frustrated by his jest honored the clarity of his vision and the passion behind it. Steve's intensity was thick from his creativity. His desirousness was thick from his asseveration on perfection. Particular jests and philosophical studies continued to impact Steve. He remained engaged with Zen Buddhism, contemplation, and indispensable cultures, integrating these perspectives into his approach to work and design. He believed in simplicity, clarity, and concentrate, principles that informed product development, business strategy, and indeed interpersonal connections. His early trials with diets, contemplation, and awareness were Entbehr pursuits. They shaped a worldview that valued sapience, suspicion, and the art of deduction, knowing what to remove in order to reveal the essential. The culture at Apple began to take shape under Steve's influence. Collaboration was essential, yet scale was smoothed in certain ways. Creativity and invention were prized above rigid processes. Workers were anticipated to push boundaries, to trial, and to embrace threat. Miscalculations were permitted if they were part of the pursuit of excellence. This combination of intensity, freedom, and vision created unique terrain, one that would latterly be described as both exhilarating and exhausting. Steve's particular style of leadership was unconventional, occasionally unpredictable, but always driven by the same core principle: a product must be beautiful, functional, and transformative. By the late 1970s, Apple faced a critical decision whether to expand beyond the layman and educational requests into the mainstream consumer space. Steve was induced that particular computers could change the world, making technology accessible, intuitive, and empowering. The Apple II's success gave the company credibility, but Steve's ambition was larger than any single product. He envisaged a future in which particular computing would be ubiquitous, flawless, and elegant, a vision that needed not just engineering, but design, marketing, and a grim pursuit of perfection. One defining occasion of this period involved the development of software for the Apple II. Steve honored that tackle alone would not serve. Software was inversely critical. He encouraged inventors to produce programs that were intuitive, stoner-friendly, and engaging. His asseveration on quality extended to law, interface design, and stoner experience. He believed that every commerce with technology should feel purposeful and elegant. This gospel, arising in the first Apple products, would latterly define the company's approach to stoner experience and interface design for decades. Steve's particular connections were evolving as well. While intensively concentrated on work, he was also forming connections with peers, instructors, and collaborators who would impact his thinking. He continued to cultivate Gemütlichkeit with masterminds, contrivers, and visionaries, blending specialized skill with aesthetic sensibility and business wit. These connections, forged during the company's constructive times, created a network of influence and collaboration that would support Apple's growth and shape the line of the tech assiduity. By the end of Occasion 1, Part 3, Apple had moved beyond its garage origins. The Apple II wasn't just a product. It was a statement, a evidence of conception for Steve's vision of accessible, elegant technology. The company had demonstrated that small brigades, driven by passion and vision, could contend with established pots. Steve Jobs had surfaced not only as a CEO founder and visionary, but also as a leader able of inspiring, challenging, and sometimes frustrating those around him. The stage was set for the coming phase of the story: expansion, invention, and battle with the challenges of growth. Steve's intensity, vision, and perfectionism would drive Apple through its constructive times, shaping products and culture likewise. He'd established the core principles that would define his approach to business and technology: grim pursuit of excellence, intuitive design, and the belief that technology could and should be beautiful. Steve Jobs' story at this point is a story of possibility. From a curious child in a San Francisco menage to a youthful man in a California garage, he'd combined intelligence, curiosity, suspicion, and passion into the onsets of a revolutionary company. The Apple I and Apple II were early expressions of a larger vision, a vision that demanded creativity, threat-taking, and unyielding commitment. What had begun as a garage trial had grown into a movement, intimating at the transformative impact that Steve Jobs would have not just on technology, but on culture, business, and mortal perception itself. Occasion one concludes with the dawn of Apple as a licit force in technology. The coming chapters would explore the explosive growth of the company, the creation of the Macintosh, the violent internal dynamics of Apple's leadership, and Steve Jobs' elaboration into one of the most influential numbers of the late 20th century. The foundation was laid, the vision was clear, and the trip of one of history's most enigmatic and brilliant minds had only just begun.